I'm going to give a talk which is a kind of general overview of some things I've been working on for more or less the past decade that grew out of an attempt to use Casimir-like methods in the context of the Standard Model and relativistic quantum field theory. It led through applications to eventually down to the scale of materials and mesoscopic systems, where most of my work is concentrated now. But that work is going to be described in, is there a pointer? I guess not. Like a laser pointer? That's a laser pointer. Small laser pointer. There we go. Thanks. I think that work's going to be described in some detail by Jamal Rahi and perhaps by Thorsten. I'm not sure whether Thorsten's giving a talk, but so this work on the scattering approach to Casimir effects, I'm not going to talk about. Instead, I'm going to spend a little time talking about the way that one can think of Casimir physics as embedded in the context of effective field theories in general, and the separation of scales that come out of that, and the interpretation of divergences that might arise in Casimir physics calculations. And then I'm going to go through six different reformulations of the same thing. There's actually the one that's being talked about here is the seventh, so that one I'm not going to talk about. Because I think it's enlightening, and I think some of the things that we got out of this study back in the Standard Model come from playing one of these off against the other and on looking at the same problem from different points of view. I actually added here a section. This is what disappeared when I tried to mount the talk last time. I added a discussion of how this works in the context of looking for solitons in the Standard Model. So I'll talk about that. And then I'll, which is a positive thing, and then I'll talk about a criticism of calculations of Casimir effects that have gone on for the last 10 or 20 years, where people encounter divergences and then claim to renormalize those divergences, and how that's actually should not be interpreted as a calculation of anything, but rather a signal that the Casimir approach is breaking down. And then finally, if we have enough time, I'll talk about some work I did a few years ago on the relationship between the Casimir effect and the dark energy problem. Here's a list of the people that I've collaborated with over the years, several of them in this room, and made great contributions to these problems. Another thing I did was to put this in alphabetical order, which that got lost also. And the people with daggers next to the name were students or are students in this process. So Casimir physics is really an extreme form of effective field theory. By the way, I should say that I know a lot of the interest here is in materials and van der Waals interactions and the Lifshitz approach. And really what I'm talking about is more related to the strict interpretation of Casimir physics in terms of boundary conditions and when that works and when it fails, although the Lifshitz extension to treating materials with an index of refraction or with epsilon and mu is quite natural. But I'm not going to be talking about Casimir physics from the point of view of molecular interactions, because I really don't know that much about it. The basic idea of effective field theory is to look for a separation of scales, to take a complex system and divide it into two systems, let's call them A and B, in which the natural energy scale or time scales of the two systems are very different. So some energy scale associated with B, the fast degrees of freedom, is much greater than the energy scale associated with A, the slow degrees of freedom. And then the traditional methods in quantum field theory are to integrate out the degrees of freedom associated with B, leaving an effective interaction that only depends on the degrees of freedom associated with A. So in Casimir physics, one tries to integrate out the vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field, leaving an effective energy that's a function of the locations of conductors, for example. But in although this method's used all the time in both condensed matter physics and high energy physics, the Casimir picture goes further in several ways. One is that one assumes that the system A is time independent, usually that it's classical, usually that it's macroscopic. And finally, that the interaction between system A and system B can be idealized by boundary conditions. Or if not by boundary conditions, by some fixed rigid response function like a permittivity and a permeability. That is, you ignore the back reaction of the fluctuating degrees of freedom on the slow degrees of freedom. And all of these can be relaxed. And relaxing them is actually what's become quite interesting in modern times, and I'll mention that. So the quantum fluctuations of system B are evaluated with system A fixed, rigid, and without back reaction. And that's a lot like a Born-Oppenheimer approximation. So you treat certain variables as classical, then you integrate out some quantum variables, then you get an effective energy as a function of these classical variables A. Then the question is, what do you do with it? Of course, if it's the force between two plates, you'd look for the force between plates. Now, I don't know if you can see this down here, but the point that I'm going to come back to over and over again is that this idealization fails if the two scales can't be separated. And the universal signature of failure is that the sum over the quantum fluctuations of system B diverges. It should never diverge, as I'll try to argue. The reason that one shouldn't encounter any divergences in Casimir calculations is that the starting point is a renormalizable quantum field theory. For example, QED. I mean, we're really, everything in this meeting so far has been discussed in the context of QED, which is a renormalized quantum field theory. It had, at some primitive level, some divergences, but those divergences were canceled at the fundamental level in terms of counterterms that were introduced and adjusted to cancel loop divergences order by order in perturbation theory. And those counterterms are not system dependent. That is, if you look at the analysis of graphs that leads you to a counterterm, you have some loop graph, it diverges. The divergence is proportional to some external field lines times, say, a logarithm of a cutoff. Divergence is canceled by a counterterm once and for all. And then one has a renormalized Lagrangian function of renormalized parameters with certain counterterms that are implemented. Yeah.
But if there are surfaces, then it can happen that there are new divergences that are really on a fundamental level for which you need new counterterms to cancel these surface similarities.
Yeah. But I want to talk about that in a certain context. We're really interested in quantum electrodynamics. We're not interested in a formal field theory that's defined with surfaces ab initio. Back in the early 1980s, Szymanczyk, among others, I mean, people usually quote this paper by Szymanczyk, pointed out that if you formulate a quantum field theory in the context of surfaces ab initio, then the standard formulation allows you to introduce counterterms that live on the surface that cancel those divergences. That's irrelevant for Casimir physics, because we don't have surfaces ab initio. We put the surfaces in as idealizations of interactions with material. We don't have any new counterterms. So if you do a Casimir calculation and you get a divergence, and you say, I'm going to cancel this with a counterterm, you're doing something formal, not necessarily physical. And one has to ask, what's the physics behind that divergence? And that's what I want to focus on. And this applies not only to QED, but also to simpler theories, like a scalar field in a scalar background or a Fermi-Dirac field in a scalar background. The latter case applies to the standard model example, where a quark couples to a Higgs field that gives it mass. So what I'm going to try to argue is that one must not encounter divergences in Casimir calculations. Just to kind of formally say what I set up here, what one does is one does the functional integral over the B field, over the B degrees of freedom of some fundamental renormalizable Lagrangian, and one gets a Casimir energy as a functional of the slow degrees of freedom. And since this is a renormalized Lagrangian, and these degrees of freedom, you're doing loop integrals over these degrees of freedom. There are no external lines associated with the fluctuating degrees of freedom. Then all you do is you're evaluating infinite sums of Feynman diagrams, all of which exist, and you're left with a finite energy. Now, of course, just to ground this in application, the classic example is, of course, Casimir's calculation of the energy between two parallel plates. The parallel plates are the degrees of freedom. The idealization is that the interaction between the photon and the charged particles and currents in the plates can be replaced by a boundary condition. And that works because the result is finite. Had this diverged, one would have to worry about that boundary condition. Useful and broadly used generalization of this is to replace the boundary condition by a frequency-dependent but still rigid and predetermined response function, namely permittivity or permeability. And I was in preparing this, I cleaned up some mistakes on this transparency, those corrections are no longer made. So there are some mistakes here. I think you'll probably find them. Instead of doing an integral over the fluctuations of the, instead of having an effective action, so this would be the fundamental action that goes into the functional integral. D would be a surface on which E and B obey boundary conditions. So in integrating out E and B, you get an effective action as a function of the surface variables. In the Lifshitz approach, do the same kind of functional integral, but now you get a functional integral as a function. The result is an effective action that's a function of the location of the objects that carry these permittivities and permeabilities. For scalar field theory, there are at least two different...
Your use of the word rigid means that the body is not changing with whatever you're doing to it. In that sense, rigid?
That's right. There's no quantum... The quantum variables in the body are frozen out. You may describe it by a linear response function, but it's still frozen.
Effective theory.
Sorry?
I mean, also the use of epsilon and mu is not fundamental.
Right. It's an effective description. For a scalar field, there are at least two different ways to implement this. One is to couple the scalar field to some fixed background. So sigma of x is the background that the field couples to. One can go to a boundary condition limit by taking this coupling to sigma, having sigma be localized on some surfaces. So sigma is an external. So sigma is some external potential that affects the fluctuations of phi, and I'll talk about limits in which this can be replaced by a boundary condition description. I should be pointing up here. Okay. So here's the potential, and then the other example is to introduce a scalar analog of an index of refraction, and I think I have this upside down. That's one of the mistakes I tried to correct. Now, another extension of this approach. So this is one extension is to no longer treat the surface as a boundary condition, but use a Lifshitz-like approach. Another extension is really quite interesting and I think is receiving a lot of attention now, is to take the Casimir energy and think of it as a potential that then you put into an effective quantum Hamiltonian for these degrees of freedom. So this is very much like the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. And an example of this is the description of a polarizable molecule moving in the presence of, say, a crystalline surface. So you calculate a la Casimir-Polder the energy of the polarizable molecule in the presence of the surface by integrating out the quantum fluctuations. That gives you a potential, an energy which you interpret as a potential, and then you put into a Schrodinger equation that you can use to describe the scattering of that molecule off the surface.
Are you speaking of Wapner reflection or?
For example. Yeah. So this could apply to de Kieffert's experiments. And in there, you actually are carrying this whole description a further level. Now there are three scales. The first scale is the scale you're integrating out, the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. The second scale is the internal structure of the molecule. You're assuming that the molecule can be regarded as rigid and not get excited during this process. And the third is that the motion of the molecule, the velocities involved, of these degrees of freedom that you're treating in this Born-Oppenheimer sense, they have to be the slowest degrees of freedom at all, because if they were fast, they would excite either the internal motion or the electromagnetic field. And there may be quite an interesting range over which those kinds of calculations are possible. Couple of new directions to mention. This I'll talk about in more detail, so you don't really have to get much out of this transparency. One is to think of this as a process of variational approximation, where one makes a postulate of some background field description, and then calculates the effective energy through the one loop level at which you are including Casimir effects, and then tries to look for the most attractive background in which those fields fluctuate. I'll come back to this again, but the basic idea is this. Imagine that you have two fields that couple to each other, one of which is characterized by fast, high energy motion, the other is a slow degree of freedom. You make an ansatz for the spatial distribution of the slow degree of freedom, calculate the fluctuations, and then ask for what spatial distribution of the slow degree of freedom are the fluctuations most energetically attractive. So in that case, it is conceivable, and we found in our studies, systems which spontaneously form solitons, because the domain that they make when they form those solitons is more attractive for the quantum fluctuations to live in. So this would be quantum stabilization of the soliton. And then in this Born-Oppenheimer kind of description, we've been working recently, we being Thorsten, Noah Graham, Meron, and myself, on orientation dependence of Casimir energy, so ellipsoidal objects, the forces that they exert on one another. And in that case, one can translate that a la Born-Oppenheimer into a spin-dependent Casimir effective potential for the interactions of atoms and molecules that carry spin, and therefore orientation. So what are the limits of this? I'll try to argue for this. This method simply fails for calculating total energy of any system. The statement, what is the Casimir energy of a conducting sphere? What is the Casimir energy of a lump of polarizable material? That's a meaningless question. In all cases, the answer is infinite. It fails for any deformation energy. If you ask, what's the Casimir pressure?
Implicitly, Chris has all these self-energy calculations.
I am. Okay. Not implicitly. I mean, the urban legend that's most well known that I'm criticizing is Boyer's calculation of the pressure on a sphere. So anything that's associated with the deformation of the object, like the pressure of a sphere, or the repulsion that a cube in isolation would feel that tries to make the cube grow larger or smaller, if you do those calculations carefully, the answer you get with boundary conditions is infinite, and that's a signal that you can't separate degrees of freedom in this way. And I'll give you explicit examples now.
How does natural gravity, because I read some time ago an article about how the Casimir energy flow, and the calculation was did for a box falling in the gravitational field. And what they found is that the Casimir energy behaves like a mass following the equivalence principle.
If they calculate the Casimir energy carefully, they'll find that it's infinite. That is, that it's cutoff dependent. When I say infinite, I'm saying you fix a boundary condition or you fix some rule, you do a calculation, you get infinity. If you back off and say, how did I get infinity? By putting a cutoff on your calculation, you find your answer goes like a power of the cutoff. And therefore, you can't take the cutoff to be infinite. For a physical system, the example in I'm anticipating myself here because your question raises it, but in Casimir's original paper, he puts a cutoff on the, in order to do a calculation, he puts a cutoff on the frequency of the modes that he sums over. And he says, I put this cutoff because the metal is transparent to X-rays. So the cutoff you should think of is the plasma frequency of the metal, for example, above which the boundary condition doesn't count. But if you do the calculation, you get an answer that goes like the cube of the cutoff frequency. You can't throw that away.
That one, when you do put real materials, you can get some kind of natural.
You can get you have to have a very steeply falling. I mean, if you write down an index of refraction.
We know it from high frequency response.
Right, but the answer depends on the model of the high frequency response. In particular, if you have a dielectric function and evaluate it on the imaginary axis, then it only falls like a power of the frequency.
You always have the X-ray vision performance off.
Yes, that's right. So that's then not a separation of scales. So the energy actually depends on the high frequency response of the system.
In a sense, one can take another point of view. Kazimir was putting a cutoff, okay, for the response of the medium, okay, saying, okay, above this cutoff it becomes, below this cutoff is imposing boundary condition, above is not imposing boundary. In a sense, what you get is, so if you keep the cutoff, in general you get a force which depends on the cutoff. Mm-hmm. And I think the observation is that if the separation between the two worlds is large enough, so you are probing the infrared limit.
Can I just correct you before you go on? You don't get the force does not depend on the cutoff. That's the crucial result. That there are interesting quantities, even when the total energy or the pressure or the stress depends on the cutoff, the forces and torques which you measure do not depend on the cutoff.
Well, actually, because actually, if you do the calculation, at the end you have to use this Bernoulli formula, and you get the whole expansion. So, and if when you compute the force, you have the leading term plus correction. So the correction actually vanishes if you are probing the infrared limit of your theory. So if your the size of your system is much larger than
that's correct
microscopic scale, then it becomes universal.
Right. So I'm talking about when the idealization is right in the limit. These are what we would call finite conductivity corrections to the Casimir effect. So it's true that the Casimir force, as you go to shorter distances, becomes more and more sensitive to high energy scales. But it's not these are corrections that vanish as the high energy scale gets higher, not ones that diverge as the high energy scale. If you calculate the stress on a sphere using Casimir method, you find corrections that diverge as the high energy scale goes to infinity. Those are very different.
I have to say, just in the defense of the sphere thing, that in the limit that the sphere is, in the limit of the sphere is
it perfectly conducting and infinitely thin.
Actually, it turns out it's you can get the cutoff independent result.
Oh, of course, perfectly conduct.
If I would take the
right,
to infinity,
right. So there is a certain strange limit where it makes sense.
Well, the sphere is very special because of its symmetry. If the sphere is infinitely thin, perfectly conducting.
Right.
And has no deformation whatsoever,
right.
Has no bumps or riddles. As soon as you make the two radii of curvature infinitesimally different from one another, that multiplies a quadratic divergence.
Know,
so that's not physics.
I know that.
Okay, we're interested in physics, not in a mathematical.
It makes sense.
I agree. If I were more pedagogically better, I would come to this in order, but I didn't end up that way.
Can I make a remark to your last statement?
Yes.
To flash it back. The last.
The last one on the last transparency.
You are right if you really take it literally, because if you compare the retarded Casimir polder with the non-retarded van der Waals interaction, in the van der Waals interaction you have a scale in there, namely the excitation energy of the molecule between ground state and excited state, but you could still do an effective field theory calculation if you take this scale into account.
Yes, that's right. I agree with that completely.
So it will not break down in this sense.
Okay. Well, it breaks down progressively. So if you have, for example, a nearby excited state, and then you can expand the Casimir calculation to be a two-channel potential, and then a three-channel potential. But then at some point, as you get closer and closer, it becomes less and less reasonable to do that. You have the whole spectrum of the molecule to consider. But that's a good point. So let me go through these six equivalent formulations, and hopefully this won't be as controversial as some of the other things I'm saying. They all start from this fundamental description. There, one tries to find the energy as a function of some slow degrees of freedom by summing over the eigenfrequencies of the appropriate fluctuating degrees of freedom in the background, in the fixed background of A. So this is the definition that I'd like to start from, is what we mean. Now, if the first formulation is simply to take this at face value and remember that in general the sum is actually an integral over density of states, and so one has an expression in terms of the not the full density of states, but the change in the density of states due to the presence of the background A. This can be formulated in this leads immediately to a scattering theory formulation of the Casimir effect. Andreas has been very active with this. It's a beautiful formulation, and it opens the door to using all kinds of methods from the vast background of scattering theory, and also it makes connections with high energy and nuclear physics, which where there's a lot of development of scattering theory. And that is that the density of states can be related to the trace of the log of the S matrix. And I guess this is the Krein formula. I always thought this was just something that was true, but we should give credit to Mr. Krein. Here's a little derivation of this. I don't know, maybe you all know this, but here's a derivation for the simplest possible case. I wish I could scroll this up. Let's look at a particle moving in one dimension. So this gray area here, whoops. Gray area disappeared as soon as I went close. So this is a gray area where there's an interaction on the line. And what we'd like to do is to calculate the density of states, the change in the density of states of, say, the Schrodinger equation due to the presence of some interaction here, but we don't know what the interaction is. All we know is the phase shift. So the solution to the Schrodinger equation for the wave function beyond the domain of interaction out here to the right is just sine kx plus delta. And I'm just going to put this in a box in order to count states. So if we put it in a box, then we set x equal to L. L is the size of the box. This has to equal n pi. This is the quantization condition for count for the number of, for the quantum number of the nth state. And if we differentiate this with respect to k, get d delta dk, we have dn dk, which is the density of states, the number of states per unit frequency. If we solve for the density of states, there are two terms. There's L over pi, which would be there whether or not there's an interaction. And there's 1 over pi d delta dk. So the change in the density of states is just 1 over pi d delta dk, but the S matrix is e to the 2i delta. So this is the log of the S matrix divided by 2i, 2 pi I. So that's the 2 pi I in that equation. And then the trace is because if you go to a diagonal, you go to the basis in which the S matrix is diagonal, then it's a bunch of phases along the diagonal because it's unitary. So you just get the trace of the log of the S matrix. So this is not the most formally rigorous definition, but this is where the basic idea comes from. So then another formulation is to relate the density of states to the Green's function. So here's a generic description of the Green's function for some field. Could be scalar, could be electromagnetic. It's a sum over all the eigenfunctions of the appropriate wave equation with the standard denominator. If we set x equal to x prime, take the trace over any spin degrees of freedom, and integrate over x, these wave functions are normalized, so they just become 1. If we take the imaginary part, each of these contributes pi times a delta function, so we end up with pi times the sum over delta functions for every k equal to one of the eigenstates of the system. That's the density of states. So once again, one has a representation for the Casimir energy, this time in terms of an integral over frequency of the trace of the Green's function, where now trace means traced over position label as well as spin labels. I assume everybody knows some of this, but is it useful to be going through this, or is this just completely redundant?
It's just how you're going to use it.
Okay, well, I'm going to get there. Okay, so then this formulation of the Green's function makes contact with Feynman diagrams. Because if you think about the Green's function G in the background of some source A, then you can expand this in some Lippmann-Schwinger expansion of the Lippmann-Schwinger equation in terms of successive couplings to this background A. Now, if you're going to trace it, the trace, of course, is just tying together the ends and integrating over everything, so it's a loop. So this expression for the Casimir energy has a direct connection to Feynman diagrams. And there's only one Feynman diagram you're throwing away. That's the one with no connection to the external field. So the Casimir energy can be related to the sum of all one-loop Feynman diagrams with an arbitrary number of external lines. This is a famous quantity in quantum field theory. This is the effective action. But it's the one loop that also got erased in my losing my latest version of this. It should have said one loop effective action for time-independent backgrounds. So a very useful formulation, and the way that you can make contact directly with Feynman diagrams and renormalizable quantum field theory is that the Casimir energy is the effective action at one loop and with a time-independent background. Finally, of course, the effective action can be written in terms of functional integrals. So by taking the appropriate relationship, one can, this is the definition of the effective action, so we end up with an energy functional of the background A. Okay, so an example of this, an example that I'm going to have in mind when I go through something quite a bit more complicated in a minute, is a renormalized Lagrangian for action for the interaction of a scalar field with a scalar background. So here's a massless scalar field. So here's the kinetic term for the massless scalar field. Here's the coupling to the background. And these terms are counter terms. They're divergent. Epsilon is the fractional dimension, say d equals 4 minus epsilon. And they're counter terms proportional to the background field A. They correspond to in four dimensions, this diagram is quadratically divergent, this diagram is logarithmically divergent, so you need counter terms linear in A and quadratic in A. And then with these counter terms, these divergent constants cancel the divergences that emerge in any calculation. This is now a completely finite renormalized action. So let me explain how all these pieces can be used in a calculation that's of some interest. There's an outstanding problem in high energy physics, which is what happens to very heavy fermions in the standard model. When the Yukawa coupling between a fermion and the Higgs field gets very large, the mass of the fermion gets large. And if you made, for example, the top quark Yukawa coupling very large, then the top quark becomes, you would think the top quark becomes irrelevant at low energy processes. But there's a problem. If you imagine that the top quark decoupled from low energy processes, then you'd only have five light quarks. And that theory has anomalies. So something has to happen. There has to be some residue of a heavy quark when you try to make it heavier and heavier in order to cancel those anomalies. Either you have to fail to decouple it, or there has to be some other low energy residuum that cancels the anomalies. And this is how we got interested in this subject. A group of us at MIT wanted to understand what happens to the top quark as its mass gets very large. And we were stimulated by some work in the early 1990s by Frank Wilczek and Lawrence Hall and their collaborators. And they made the following kind of argument. Here's the physics of their argument. The top quark gets its mass because the scalar field has a vacuum expectation value, V. And so the term in the Lagrangian, if you expand phi about its vacuum expectation value, is GV times psi bar psi, and the mass is GV. This suggests that if you have a top quark somewhere, it would be energetically favorable for the top quark to drill a hole in the condensate, to evacuate the condensate to some extent in its neighborhood, because then the effective value of V that it sees would be smaller. Now, in doing that, the yellow is a cartoon of the Higgs condensate. This costs energy at the classical level. The Higgs field deviates from its minimum in its potential, so that costs energy, and it has a gradient, so that costs energy. So in doing this, you have Higgs potential energy and Higgs kinetic or curvature energy. On the other hand, the fermion is strongly bound in this Higgs background. If you solve the Dirac equation in the presence of this background, the lowest eigenvalue of the Dirac equation is much less than G times V. So you've gained quantum energy from making this deformation. And the papers of that I referred to in the early 1990s argued, did some sample calculations, and they found, for example, for the top course of with a mass of 175 GeV, the effect of this effect was at the 5 to 10% level. Now, if this were true, it would mean that the mass of the top quark that's measured in experiments is not the mass that appears in the Lagrangian. It doesn't tell you the Yukawa coupling in the Lagrangian. There's this non-perturbative bag-like object that is the physical top quark.
But wrong?
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah. So I think that's right. But however, this calculation is inconsistent, and this is what got us interested in the subject. When you make this deformation of the Higgs field, you don't change only the lowest eigenvalue of the Dirac equation, you change all of them. And although only the lowest mode is occupied with this top quark that's in here, there's a Casimir energy from having deformed all of the spectrum, and you can't ignore that. So the vacuum energy of the top quark field in the presence of the scalar background changes when you deform the scalar background. And that's a Casimir effect. So we wanted to try to calculate the sum of 1/2 h bar omega to find out whether the deformation of the Higgs field that you've made is a favorable or unfavorable place for the fermion to fluctuate, as well as to have one of its modes live there. And this led us to this long and rich reformulation of this field, of this subject in particle physics. So we wanted to combine the Casimir sum with the Feynman diagram methods because this is a calculation in a well-defined renormalizable field theory. All of the renormalization conditions, we want to calculate the energy of this as a functional of the field phi, but also as a function of the renormalized Yukawa coupling and mass of the Higgs field. We can't calculate this in terms of some parameters that are not renormalized in the standard way, because we have to know that we're holding these parameters fixed as we look for a variational minimum in this energy of the functional of the phi field. So we have to learn how to implement standard renormalization. But standard renormalization is done in terms of Feynman diagrams. So we have to relate Casimir energy to Feynman diagram calculation. And that's what this says here. The Feynman graph divergences are canceled by the divergent counterterms. And there are no ambiguities because these are resolved by putting renormalization conditions on the low-order Green's functions, that the coupling constant should be such and such and the mass should be such and such. So what we wanted to do was to subtract away those pieces of the Casimir calculation associated with low-energy, low-order Feynman diagrams, then add back in the Feynman diagrams and perform conventional renormalization. Once you've done that, you then have an energy functional over which you can look for a minimum with respect to variations in this Higgs background. So here's a little bit more of an explanation. There's an effective field, there's a one-loop effective action in the background of a Higgs field. It's time independent, so it's the effective action just factors into the time times an effective energy. And then we're working at one loop. Because it's a Casimir energy we're calculating. We know the Casimir energy is identified with the one loop effective action. There are three contributions. There's the classical calculation, the classical contribution to the energy. There's the one loop contribution, and there are the counterterms. The one loop contributions have this form. We subtract the vacuum. That's the Casimir energy. Um, we write the Casimir energy in terms of an integral over the density of states, but we separate out the bound states in this background, if there are any. The deformation of the density of states, we use the Krein formula to relate the deformation of the density of states to the derivative of the eigenphases in all the different channels, which have isospin as well as spin labels. We can calculate the phase shifts candidate background of the scalar field, but we have to do this calculation subject to a regulator, because if we do this calculation in four dimensions without a cutoff, it's going to be infinite. So we do the calculation in n dimensions, in fractional dimensions. So we have to calculate scattering amplitudes and phase shifts in fractional dimensions, which is not hard. And then we have to identify the potentially divergent terms, and we have to find a way to regulate them. It turns out one can show that the Born expansion of the phase shift, that is the power series expansion of the phase shift in terms of insertions of the external lines, is in one-to-one correspondence with the Feynman diagrams. So if one takes the phase shift, which one's calculating to get the density of states, and subtracts the first two Born approximations to the phase shift, then one's removing the contribution to the effective energy of the first two Feynman diagrams. What's left then is a cutoff independent and finite integral over the phase shift. All the divergences are associated with the first two Feynman diagrams, and therefore with the first two Born approximations. So one can check that this works. The high energy behavior of the Born diagrams is what contributes to the divergences, and this works in practice. But now one subtracted these two Feynman diagrams, one has to add them back in again. But instead of adding them back in as integrals over phase shift, one adds them in as explicit Feynman diagrams, which one knows how to renormalize in the presence of the counter terms. So this is my last slide on this. This is a kind of summary of the whole thing. One then gets an effective renormalized energy functional of the background field in which the renormalization has been carried out explicitly. And this formula incorporates everything. It's not actually as complicated as it looks. There's the classical energy, which is just obtained by taking the classical Hamiltonian and substituting whatever deformed Higgs background you want to study. Then there are the contributions of the Feynman diagrams, the first and second Feynman diagrams, which can be calculated for an external field. So this is a fermion coupled to phi with one loop and one or two insertions of phi. And then there are the counterterms necessary to renormalize it, which you can look up in a book. Then there's the contribution of all the rest of the sum over the density of states, the bound states, and the integrals the integral over the phase shifts. There's some little subtlety having to do with infrared behavior, where one has to subtract the mass in both these terms, and that turns out to be an identity enforced by Levinson's theorem. Renormalization is standard. There's no tadpoles. The first derivative with respect of the two-point function is the wave function renormalization, and the two-point function at zero momentum is the mass squared. This is then a machine, and one can study all the effects at one loop of Casimir fluctuations. So this gave an effective one loop, that is order H bar quantum description to study solitons. Now the answer was that the quantum fluctuations of the fermion field destabilized the system. So when you deform the Higgs field, the fermion field does not like to fluctuate. It costs more energy than you gain by lowering the one occupied level. So this way of non-perturbative modification in the standard model does not occur. It's not energetically favorable. There are cases where it is energetically favorable. In one dimension, a scalar field coupled to a chiral fermion for a wide range of parameters. If you have a symmetry breaking scalar field, so there's a constant VeV, then this system will spontaneously tie itself up into a knot in such a way that to provide a region where the fermions like to fluctuate. So there are systems which spontaneously form solitons in order to provide better environments for Casimir fields. Okay, back to or back away from particle physics for a minute. So how do we square? I want to now talk about the divergences a little more detail. If in fact Casimir energies are one-loop effective energies in renormalizable quantum field theory, which I think I've argued for, then they're finite. But if one just looks at this sum that one computes, it's horribly divergent. For example, in Casimir's calculation, the sum itself is cubically divergent when you subtract the vacuum term. And there has been a major industry of computing Casimir energies for objects that are superficially divergent, then regulating and renormalizing them through a whole series of technical tricks. And in brief, if a Casimir calculation diverges, it's a sign that the idealization has failed and the quantity in question is not protected from high frequency scales. And this can easily be seen from the formalism of Balian and Bloch, which has been around for almost 40 years. It's a beautiful formalism. Let me just describe it. This work is in 1970 and led to the later work by Balian and Duplantier on the Casimir effect. They were interested in the question of whether you can hear the shape of a drum. They were trying to study the density of states as a function of the geometry. As probably many of you know, they derived an integral equation, which is like a Lippmann-Schwinger equation, where the kernel is a surface reflection kernel for the cavity for a Green's function in some geometrically specified domain. Then they smoothed it by looking at wave number k, which has a small positive imaginary part, and then taking the limit that the imaginary part goes to zero. The density of states is a highly oscillatory function in a cavity. It's just a sum, it's a comb of delta functions. But by going off the real axis, you smooth that out and you can obtain an asymptotic expansion for the density of states at high frequency, which begins with a universal term, the Weyl term, order k squared. It's what I've written here is for a Dirichlet scalar. These coefficients change for a Neumann scalar, and they change for Dirac fields or electromagnetic fields. The first term is quadratic in K, the next term is linear in K, the next term is independent of K. This is the sum of the principal curvatures. There's a log K term times the difference of principal curvatures, and the last term that I could find in their work is a term that goes like 1 over K. That's the integral of the Gaussian curvature.
Fourth term should be squared, no?
Sorry?
The difference of the principal curvatures should be squared.
Oh, is that right? I'm sorry. Thank you. But if you look at these, they all yield divergent contributions to the Casimir energy, to the vacuum energy. This one diverges cortically, cubically, quadratically. If this is squared, then this diverges linearly. Huh? You don't think it's square?
But it's the difference of the principal curvatures is not a scalar.
Oh, what kind of scalar?
It's a symmetric scalar. So it's hard to imagine how it would arise.
Oh, well, that's a point. Yeah, that's true. That's true. And then the product of the principal curvatures is the last term, and that diverges linearly. So what are all these divergences, and how does one identify and compute the underlying finite term that contributes to the force? Well, so some comments on this. Here's the formula again. As I mentioned, it's for the smooth density of states. It fails to capture all the oscillatory terms that are present at finite k. All the smooth terms that they found yield divergences in the Casimir energy. The divergences are all local on the surface. If you look at the multiple reflection expansion, they all come from the points at which Green's functions coincide, the coincident points on the surface. And so all these divergences, if you were to regulate them, would be carried around if the surface moves, and they all therefore cancel out of any forces and torques where the surfaces are displaced rigidly. So the forces that you measure, so you can actually prove this by taking two different domains, moving them infinitesimally from one another, repeating the multiple reflection expansion calculation, and seeing that all the divergent terms are identical because they only refer to one surface or the other. So all of these terms have nothing to do with the Casimir forces that are measured. In fact, the Casimir forces come entirely from the subdominant oscillatory terms in the density of states. This is an example. This is the density of states between two semi-permeable points on a one-dimensional line. This is the kind of thing that you have to add up. This is the Baumann-Bloch asymptotic smooth density of states, and the integral under this thing is zero. The integral of the difference between the fluctuations and the smooth curve is zero, but this is the term that gives rise to the Casimir energy between these two semi-permeable points. So direct computation of the Casimir effect by integrating the density of states is extremely difficult. All the smooth dominant terms give nothing, and the actual contribution comes from the fluctuations. These divergences have nothing to do with the short distance behavior of quantum field theory. One example of that is that there's cubic divergence for a scalar field in three dimensions, and there are no cubic divergences in quantum field theory for a scalar field in three dimensions. So that divergence, for example, it has no fundamental origin. On the other hand, if you were to compare the energy of two different systems, say a sphere and a sphere with a little dimple in it, then the difference would not cancel out. In fact, the difference would diverge, and that's a cutoff dependence. These divergences are also visible in the Casimir energy density. Candelas and his students back in the early 1980s looked at the behavior of the vacuum expectation value of the stress tensor in the presence of surfaces. And although it's finite in any location away from the surface, if you take the limit as you approach a surface, the energy density diverges. And this divergence in the energy density is exactly correlated with the divergence of these terms in the density of states. So the divergence comes from trying to constrain a quantum field to vanish, for example, to vanish for all frequencies. It's not surprising that you would get a divergence if you try to make a quantum field do something for all frequencies, because you're introducing an arbitrarily strong interaction into the system. If you put a finite strength interaction into a quantum field theory, you can't make all frequency components of the field vanish at some point. You can make the components up to scales of order that frequency vanish, but if you go to high enough frequency scales, any fixed interaction is no longer strong enough to enforce the boundary condition. And trying to put in an arbitrarily strong interaction, infinitely strong interaction, into the theory generates these divergences. And to see that, you can study that through the Feynman diagrams by putting in external lines that are that describe a coupling to an external field that has finite frequency strength, and then trying to take the limit that you enforce the boundary condition by going to an arbitrarily strong interaction. Here's an example from one dimension, which is so simple that it can be seen without detailed calculation. I'll show you how this works in higher dimensions in a minute. Let's look at a Dirichlet point. So a Dirichlet point is just a line. So we have a field sigma of x, a background field, and we try to set some fluctuating field equal to zero at this point zero. Okay. So we try to put the boundary condition phi of 0 equals 0. So if we have one point, that defines a Casimir energy in the background of a vanishing point, E1. And if we have two points, say at A and minus A, then that gives us a Casimir energy as a function of the variable A. Here's the standard argument. I'm doing this a little quickly. This can be done more carefully, but here's the standard argument. For one point, there's no energy associated with it. The argument is that if you don't have the boundary condition, then the modes are sine x and cosine x for k greater than 0, sine kx, cosine kx. But if you constrain the modes to vanish, the eigenfunctions are sine kx and sine k times the absolute value of x. But these spectra are exactly identical. And therefore, there's no, when you sum the constrained minus the unconstrained eigenfrequencies, you get zero. Now, on the other hand, if you take the two points, so you have a system vanishing at minus a and a, then a standard calculation gives an energy of h bar c times pi over 48a. And here's how the standard calculation is done. The argument is that the modes outside of these points are the same in both cases, so they cancel. The modes inside obey a boundary condition. The wave function is sine kx plus a, but k has to, this has to vanish at x equals plus a, so k has to be n pi over 2a. This is a massless field. I sum the energy, so I have h bar c over 2 times the sum of these eigenfrequencies. The sum is n pi over 2a. Okay. Factor everything out, it's the sum of n from 1 to infinity. Everybody knows that's divergent, right? We all know that's divergent, okay? But this calculation manages to make it into minus a 12th, okay? So what you do is you regulate it, which is perfectly reasonable. So you define a zeta function, n to the minus s, that gives me a zeta of s. And then you analytically continue this to s equal minus 1, which is what it has to be for the sum, and you find a zeta of minus 1 is minus a 12th, and you get h bar c pi over 48a. Okay. So this is the standard answer for E2, and the standard answer for E1. This is exactly how the calculation is done for E2. So what's wrong with this? Well, first of all, it doesn't make any sense, because if E1 is 0, I put a twiddle over these because they're wrong in some sense. They're too naive. It doesn't make any sense because as A goes to 0, that is, as these two Dirichlet points come together, you should have one Dirichlet point. Right? Then the field only vanishes at one point. But it doesn't work that way. It should be that E2 goes to E1, but E1 is 0, and the limit of this as A goes to 0 is minus infinity.
Well, there wasn't. So with a cutoff, then you have a much larger than lambda to minus one, and then you have.
So let's do the calculation with a cutoff, okay? Okay. So and there's another problem with this, by the way. The other problem is that a massless scalar quantum field theory doesn't exist in one dimension. The theory has infrared divergences. So if you were to do this for a finite mass and take the limit as m goes to zero, you should get a log m divergence, and there's no sign of a log m divergence in either of these formulas. So it's been done too naively. To study it more carefully, and this is just a cartoon problem, we use the methods that we developed for this high-energy physics analysis. We write down a coupling between this fluctuating scalar field and a background field sigma. And the background field sigma is going to be you imagine it to be smooth, and you're going to try to take a limit where this enforces the boundary condition. Okay, so to enforce a boundary condition, the field sigma has to be concentrated only at the point, and its coupling to the background, to the fluctuating field, has to go to infinity. So there are two stages. Sigma has to go to a delta function, and the coupling strength G between the background and the fluctuating field has to become infinite. That's the condition that every mode of phi vanishes at the point x. If it just becomes a delta function, then the field phi will make a jump in its derivative at x, but it won't have to be zero. So one has to be careful about the divergences here. If you calculate the one-loop effective action for this theory, there's a divergent diagram in two dimensions, which is this diagram. This gives a divergence proportional to, here's sigma. This gives a divergence proportional to sigma of x, and therefore we have to introduce a counter term to cancel it. So here's the counter term. It turns out that in two dimensions, the limit, this is 1 plus 1 dimension, the limit in which the background is taken to be sharp isn't sick by itself. There are no divergences in that limit. So I'm going to take that limit carelessly. Let the scalar field be a delta function. Let's the background field be a delta function. then this is a this is an easy calculation. The energy of a fluctuating quantum field coupled to a background with mass m in the background of a delta function at the origin is this. This is for normalized. If you notice, there's no term proportional to g here. If you take g to 0, the term in expanding the logarithm exactly cancels against this. That's because I chose a renormalization condition, which is that there are no tadpoles. If you want to have a fixed value for the tadpole graph, you would just be adding a constant to this.
So basically now you have localized the interaction at x equals 0.
Yes.
But you keep the boundary condition solved.
Yes. That's right.
Because this reminds a lot what the people in critical phenomena are doing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You put a soft boundary condition, then you study what happens to the couplings of the soft boundary condition when you do a normalization group analysis. And then this is going to end up in a fixed point boundary condition that might be here.
Now this idea of a soft boundary condition only works in 1+1 dimension. When you go to higher dimensions for this field theory, you can't take the limit that the background collapses to a point. It actually diverges in that limit, as you'll see in a minute. So this is a finite answer, and it depends on the coupling strength and on the mass, and one can analyze it. It converges for any coupling strength, so it's finite, and for mass not equal to zero. But as the mass goes to zero, it diverges logarithmically. So that's what you expect. You expect a one-dimensional scalar field theory to have a logarithmic divergence. You apply the same methods and calculate the energy for the two points. Again, now idealized as two delta functions. So these are soft boundary conditions. And you get an expression for the energy. So these were both computed using this S-matrix method I described earlier. Now you can check, does this make sense? And yes, it does make sense. It has to make sense because this is a renormalizable quantum field theory, and everything's finite. So as you take the limit that A goes to infinity, so you take these far apart, the two-point interaction collapsed to just twice the single energy. That's good. As you take A to 0, the two-point interaction becomes the one-point interaction with twice the strength. You're taking two delta functions, you put them on top of each other, you get twice the strength. As you take the mass to 0, all these energies diverge logarithmically. So let's now try to take the limit that this becomes a sharp interaction, so that it actually constrains the field to vanish at the point x. That's the limit that g goes to infinity, and this energy E2 simply diverges in that limit. It diverges like g log g. This is not a divergence due to a Feynman diagram. It's completely renormalizable field theory. It diverges because we've tried to put too much momentum into these graphs. We've tried to constrain the field at all frequencies. And this tells you that the notion of a Casimir energy for these two points doesn't make any sense. You can't take the limit of a very sharp, strong interaction necessary to make a boundary condition. However, if you calculate the force, so if I calculate dE2 by dA, the derivative of this finite energy as a function of separation, and take the limit that g goes to infinity, that gives h bar c over 48a squared, the same answer you would get from the zeta function regularization. So there's nothing wrong with regulating a finite quantity and then taking the regulator away, regulating some intermediate state and taking the regulator away. But there is something wrong with regulating and then throwing away an infinity, because that infinity is a real infinity. Okay, so just a glimpse at higher dimensions. We wrote a whole paper about life in 3+1 dimensions. Here's the contribution to the two-point function. Just this graph with a field sigma of x interacting with a background sigma of x in two dimensions in the renormalized quantum field theory. So the renormalization here is clear because of this mu squared. The two-point function has been chosen so that at p squared equal mu squared, it's equal to zero. So this is a finite kernel for the one-loop two-point function. And the place where the background appears is in the Fourier transform of the background field sigma. So this is sigma of p, bringing in momentum p, and this is sigma of p, sigma of minus p, bringing in momentum minus p. And for any sufficiently smooth function sigma of x whose Fourier transform falls fast enough, this is a convergent quantity. But if you try to take the limit that sigma of p is the Fourier transform of a delta function on a surface, you try to make this field vanish on a surface, the high energy behavior of sigma p makes this diverge. And this is the uniform character of all these divergences. They diverge because of the external line carrying too much momentum. So the divergences are associated with trying to idealize the behavior of material by an external, by a boundary condition. If you were to put in the real behavior of the material here, you'd get the right answer. That answer might or might not depend on the high energy behavior of these Fourier transforms. If it doesn't depend on the high energy behavior, then there's a separation of scales necessary to treat this in a Casimir language. If you're calculating forces, it will never depend on the high energy behavior. It will only depend on the low energy behavior of the background fields. And this argument applies to all of these papers where you try to calculate the total Casimir energy of some system with a definite shape.
Is this not equivalent? Why do you calculate the force and the force is finite? This is not equivalent to add, let's say, we have a slab to consider the force for the other side of the mirror, and this is an infinite force which does not depend on the distance between the mirrors. It's just the backing pressure of the other side of the mirror, and this cancels exactly the divergence in the force inside the cavity.
Sure. For a simple geometry like a mirror, it's trivial. I mean, it cancels by simply some simple subtraction like that. But let's consider a sphere. If you go back to the Balian and Bloch density of states for a sphere, the various coefficients for the different modes, transverse electric and transverse magnetic, cause these terms all to cancel. So, for example, the transverse electric and magnetic have opposite surface terms here. So they cancel. The volume term cancels because you're comparing it to empty space. This term vanishes between inside and outside because the definition of the principal curvatures are negative when viewed from the inside. Right? All these terms, and the same for the Gaussian curvature. So these all vanish for a sphere. Okay, and that's why Boyer got a finite answer. But for a physical sphere, this doesn't cancel because the radius of curvature of the inside and the outside of the sphere are not the same. The sphere has to have finite thickness in order to have infinite conductivity or very large conductivity. So, or for example, if the sphere has a tiny dimple on it, if R1 has if there's a region on the sphere where R1 is not exactly equal to what it is on the inside, right? So those subtractions that you're describing don't work except for parallel plates.
Because of the force of the side, the backing pressure, the free backing pressure, is curvature dependent.
That's right. It's a little bit different on the outside than it is on the inside. But then when you conclude that, you get something that goes like the plasma frequency squared, right? So there is an energy due to the vacuum fluctuations in the presence of a sphere, but it depends on the high energy behavior of the material out of which the sphere is made. And when you push on a sphere with your finger, you change those vacuum fluctuations. But you also change a lot of other things that are going on at that same energy scale because you're moving around the molecules on the sphere. So the notion of a Casimir pressure on a sphere is just not well defined. It's all having to do with the high energy binding behavior of the material that the sphere is made out of. Okay, I have one last thing to talk about, which is, can I have 5 minutes to talk about this, cosmological constant? So this is basically trying to demystify the Casimir effect a little bit. And, since we all love this effect, we shouldn't like to see its name taken in vain. A dark energy was discovered in the mid-1990s. Weinberg and others emphasized that in quantum field theories, as conventionally formulated, there is an energy 1/2 h bar omega associated with the fluctuation of all the modes in the vacuum. And this fluctuation energy should contribute to the cosmological constant. And the reason is that in Einstein's equation on the right-hand side, there, the thing that occurs on the right-hand side is the full energy momentum tensor, stress tensor of the world. And that includes both the stress tensor due to matter and the stress tensor due to the vacuum fluctuations. And one characteristic of this is that it's very large. Since it diverges quartically, you might imagine some cutoff at the Planck scale. And this number is the famous 120 orders of magnitude larger than the dark energy that was observed. And sometimes people said, well, how do we know the vacuum fluctuations are real? And so uniformly, almost every paper on this subject begins with the statement that we know vacuum fluctuations are real because of the Casimir effect. And Weinberg's is probably the best. Perhaps surprisingly, it was a long time before particle physicists began seriously to worry about quantum zero-point fluctuation contributions to the cosmological constant, despite the demonstration in the Casimir effect of the reality of zero-point energies. Sean Carroll says the vacuum fluctuations themselves are very real, as evidenced by the Casimir effect. Now, I believe that quantum field theory, I know of no formulation of quantum field theory in which vacuum fluctuations can be ignored and removed. However, the Casimir effect has no particular special relevance to vacuum fluctuations. It is a one-loop quantum correction to energies, and it's like any other one-loop quantum correction, like the Lamb shift or G-2. It's evidence of quantum fluctuations coupling to material, not to the vacuum. And one of the reasons that this causes a lot of confusion is that the Casimir effect looks so deep and universal. If you look at the famous formula for the force per unit area, it depends on nothing but H bar and C. In particular, it doesn't depend on the fine structure constant. There's no fine structure constant in this. So it looks like it's a property of the vacuum, not a property of material. The reason for that is that this formula is actually the alpha goes to infinity limit. And probably everybody in the room knows this, but it's not widely appreciated outside of, your community, the condensed matter, atomic physics, molecular physics community would be more ready to understand that the Casimir effect really depends on the fine structure constant. In my world, particle physicists, people don't understand that. If you let the fine structure constant go to zero, the conductivity vanishes and the Casimir effect vanishes. And it's easy to see what the important scale is. The plasma frequency has to be large compared to the natural frequencies that control the Casimir effect. And C over D for parallel plates is a good measure of the frequencies that are important. If one writes down some simple model, this is a Drude model, this is a plasma model, right. So, right, that's why it's a plasma frequency. Then one can find out how large the fine structure constant has to be in order to ignore the finite conductivity effects. And the answer is it has to be greater than about 10 to the minus fifth, which it's of 1 over 137. So as far as the calculation goes, except for small finite conductivity corrections, which are, of course, very interesting, you can treat the fine structure constant as if it's infinite, and you get a formula that doesn't depend on it. Furthermore, there are formulations of the Casimir effect in which one dispenses with the vacuum entirely. Schwinger, in the 1970s, went to great lengths to reformulate quantum field theory as source theory, in which the only physically important ingredients are S matrix elements, with external lines, there's no reference at all to a vacuum. And he calculates, of course, the same Casimir force. It's a little bit like the relationship between the electrostatic energy of two charges calculated from Coulomb's law, or integrating twice by parts, expressing it in terms of the electric field squared. The fact that you can write the electrostatic energy in terms of an electric field doesn't mean the electric field is real. You know the electric field is real when you start seeing propagating modes of the electric field. In particular, diagrammatically, you can see the distinction. The Casimir effect is explicitly those diagrams with external lines. So these are the diagrams in the one-loop effect of action for the Casimir effect. And the vacuum energy is the sum of all diagrams with no external lines. So measuring diagrams with external lines, that's the stuff of all of physics. And it tells you nothing in principle about diagrams with no external lines. Now, Schwinger was trying to reformulate all of quantum field theory without mentioning the vacuum in terms of S matrix elements. And he was more or less able to do that for quantum electrodynamics. You can calculate anything you're interested in quantum electrodynamics, for example, scattering amplitude. All the higher order corrections can be calculated dispersively in terms of lower order diagrams, which are tree graphs with no reference to fluctuating fields. Since Schwinger's time, we've run into a problem with that. And so Schwinger might argue that the vacuum energy of a quantum field is meaningless, because he could do all of quantum field theory without ever invoking the notion of a vacuum. We don't have that luxury nowadays because of quantum chromodynamics. In quantum chromodynamics, the S matrix elements are all hadrons. All of the states, all of the asymptotic states are hadrons. But the fundamental field theory is in terms of quarks and gluons. So nobody knows how to formulate quantum chromodynamics entirely in terms of S matrix elements. And so I think everybody who's tried to study this field knows of no other way of formulating quantum field theory without reference to a vacuum, which leads you to vacuum energy, which leads you to a cosmological constant. However, the Casimir energy plays no particular primary role in the argument that the vacuum fluctuations are real. So that's it.
Can I ask you the point about relationship underlying theory, effective field theory? You mentioned, I mean, there should be no further divergences. That's true if you probably use the same degrees of freedom or the degrees of freedom that come from the underlying theory. But as in your example of QCD, if the low energy effective field theory for QCD is this Hall perturbation theory in terms of pions, and where you encounter at any order divergences that you have to regularize, right? I mean,
right.
If you happen to have this situation of QCD, where you also say that you have to take the vacuum series, then I think one escapes your statement that you don't have to worry about new classes of divergences.
Well, it's not so much that, if you do effective field theories, like a chiral effective field theory in a consistent way, you end up with explicit dependence in terms of subtraction constants on the high energy degrees of freedom. Right? So you're carefully treating a normalizable field theory. You don't encounter divergences. What you encounter are explicit dependences on those degrees of freedom. The same would be true if you calculated the Casimir effect with the same amount of care. For example, if you calculated the Casimir energy of a sphere, you'd find that it depends explicitly on these high frequency degrees of freedom. And then, when you calculate the Casimir force between two spheres, you'd find that that dependence cancels out. So also, in studying an effective field theory, if I wrote an effective Lagrangian for pions, it would have all kinds of dependence on these high energy degrees of freedom. But if I calculate pi-pi scattering at low energies, those terms cancel out, except for small corrections of order p squared over 4 pi f pi squared. So it's a question of, if it's a question of order of limits, if you like. If you try to take the high energy degrees of freedom away from the problem ab initio, you would have divergences.
Okay.
You're right that when you are dealing with measurement of the Casimir effect, you're dealing with the real material, and in this case, you can almost treat the field as a classical field. At least, in the, I know, for example, it's exactly what Lifshitz did, and he gave a quantum nature just to the matter, to the currents flowing in the mirrors. But so there is no quantum vacuum for the field in this derivation. But
I don't think I would agree to that, actually.
The
H-bar is out in front. And the thing that's confusing about the role of quantum mechanics in Casimir calculations is the H-bar is in front of the whole calculation. So the trace is over the over the classical Green's function. So what Lifshitz is doing is tracing the classical Green's function over K. So it's true that he only calculates the propagation of classical degrees of freedom, but that's basically doing the one-loop integral.
Yeah, but Mena, in this case, well, when you are saying that the Casimir energy has nothing to do with the quantum vacuum of the electromagnetic field, are you saying that the field is quantum without a vacuum energy, or is it a classical quantum?
I'm saying exactly this. If you took the Hamiltonian of the field theory, and you normal ordered the fields at every order in perturbation theory and put that term aside, okay, then the Hamiltonian consists of a normal ordered piece that has zero vacuum expectation value, plus a bunch of terms that are vacuum terms. That if you were to simply throw away all those vacuum terms, you'd get the fine calculation of any Casimir effect you're interested in. You could consistently ignore all vacuum energies and get the same answer for all Casimir effects. I don't know a way of formulating quantum field theory where you can consistently ignore those terms if you couple them to gravity, because they're still in the Hamiltonian.
I just was wondering, just because you, in the quantum field theory, you treat the field as an independent quantity from the source in some sense, mm-hmm. which is on correlation functions, and those correlation functions as a vacuum term. So if this vacuum term does not play a role as it is in the Casimir field, in the Casimir energy, I was wondering if it's just a problem with the Casimir energy, or it's a general situation, a general problem, you know?
I think that what Schwinger did was actually to go through process after process order, and then regularly order by order in perturbation theory, and show that you could consistently ignore all vacuum terms and all correlators at all stages in the calculation and not affect any physical S matrix element. And I'm not sure why he wanted to do that, because we all know that later on, he, in his work with Milton, they were actually quite eager to calculate Casimir energies. So you'd have to ask him. But Jamal, did you have a question?
So you pointed out, I think many times now, that it's the UV divergences that screw up the self-energy calculations for a single perfectly conducting string. But suppose you took a dielectric, mm-hmm. then what you would call the total, you could define something called the total Casimir energy of mm-hmm. a dielectric sphere, which would not be divergent. And you could change the mass of a sphere by changing its dielectric properties.
So if you have a dielectric function, I mean, let's make a model with a dielectric function that falls rapidly enough at high momenta that all these integrals converge, then you would have a Casimir energy as a functional of that dielectric constant. And it would, I do want to emphasize, it would depend on how that dielectric constant falls at high energies, because otherwise it would not be finite. That's a contribution to the energy of the sphere, and therefore it changes the mass of the sphere.
Has somebody done this calculation just to have an idea of how big this mass correction is? Or is it easy to do?
We had a talk from the Monolith that mentioned.
But he was measuring a change in mass. Okay, but it was a very small change in the electric constant.
There's this paper of Milton where he calculated the equivalent mass of the Casimir energy of the box, and showed that because the equivalent principle is working. So.
Well, the equivalent, that's known with the equivalent. I mean, you could look at different isotopes and then you can show them there. That can make part to the mass difference of a proton neutron.
And then
work it out, and you know that the equivalence principle is working. I mean, from the equivalence principle, where you have the bound on the inertia mass and the gravitational mass of 10 to the minus 30, that they check, you get basically by dividing out alpha. You get 10 to the minus 10, I think, in this order, right, isn't it?
I didn't follow the orders. Are you talking about calculations based on nuclear
quantum? Well, you just make the equivalence principle, I mean, the soft or the weak equivalence principle measurements, and then you can get a bound on the on how far self-radiation is respecting the equivalence.
I guess that by Milton, the point was that the Casimir energy is negative, so you have a negative mass which is connected with.
But the Casimir energy is not negative. The Casimir energy is
positive. That's on top. That's because Milton throws away the infinity.
Yeah.
I mean, Milton is one of the. I wish he were here so we could discuss this. I mean, if you properly treat the cutoff dependence, you're going to find that the Casimir energy of a sphere or a cube is huge and positive.
But
the negative piece is a finite piece that coming from the oscillations, that underlies these very much larger divergent positive pieces.
Well, let's take the case of, okay.
Okay, thank you.